everybody. I'm Jeremy. We're in the season of Advent, which is from the Latin term Adventus, which means the coming. We're waiting for God to come into the world to make a home in humanity as Jesus. So I'll be talking tonight about how God uses the Magi in his global homemaking strategy. So to sum it up in one sentence, I think Pope Gregory the Great said it best in the late 500s. He was waxing poetical, thinking about the Magi and their role in the story of Jesus coming into the world. And he said, "Having come to know Jesus, we are forbidden to return by the way we came." I think it sums it up really nicely because the Magi are some role players that I often overlook because I think of them as these just guys in the nativity scene that I don't know how to relate to. And then I read the last part of the last line of Matthew's account and was kind of blown away. It was like the last half of the sentence where it just says, you know, it went home another way. And I heard it really differently, so I just want to talk about even just that last bit of that sentence tonight. But if there's one thing you can hold on to, it's this. So I'll probably just leave it up for a minute. Jesus is making a new home in us and for us, and God uses the Magi to demonstrate a new way for us to live in this new home. And here's two ways that he's doing that. In an often confusing, foreign, and dangerous environment, focus on locating Jesus, joyfully worshiping him and offering all you've been generously given, no matter the cost to your life or your reputation. And if you've been given a lot, like education or wealth, political and social connections, talents, time, money, you're invited by Jesus to significantly change how you live once you finally find him. Hey, Michael. I love your smile. Can someone, Michael, do you mind reading this for us? I love the way you read, too. I really do, man. Do you mind? Thanks, my friend.
Then King Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route.
Thanks, Michael. You should hear this guy give a presentation to the ZBA. It's even smoother. Thanks, man. That's the basic account of the Magi, and it's only found in one of the Gospels, which I learned this year. So who are the Magi, and what role do they play in this homemaking project? They were upper class, similar to the scribes, so they were literate, which was rare. Matthew doesn't mention that there are three, necessarily, but their number is linked often to the number of gifts that they bring Jesus, or the number of types of gifts, if you will. Some later accounts claim up to 12, which is also probably symbolic. There's some paintings I found that are amazing that have this like long entourage. I mean, if you can imagine traveling as far as they did, you're gonna need a lot of resources. So to think of it as just three guys or something, I mean, it's very symbolic in a lot of ways, so whichever way makes sense to you to use it this year, use that. A lot of people have done that because Matthew doesn't give a lot of details. Up until about 150 years ago, most people were illiterate in the world, and serious study was linked to religious devotion. So the Magi were probably not only literate, but were somewhere between advanced scientists and advisors to the highest government officials. They're often even called kings themselves. So think of, I mean, maybe one way that's helpful is thinking these are kings coming to worship, coming to recognize and pay homage to a king. So short of trying to figure out getting all the facts straight about them, I don't think that's as important as knowing that their main role is paying homage to the king, to Jesus. When they finally locate him, they joyously fall down and kneel before Jesus to worship him as one would a king. You don't do that to people who don't have that when you recognize their power, that's kind of what it does. So this is not a normal greeting that they have, and I think that I would just read over that like, oh yeah, this is like what happens. Some people say that started the tradition of the Christians kneeling in worship before Jesus as an act of worship. It was largely lost in the West, but in a lot of parts of Christendom, it's kneeling is a main way to worship Jesus. So tonight, though, I'm interested mostly in their interaction with power with a capital P, and that would be this guy, King Herod, whose history is really sordid. One thing you might just want to check out is look up who King Herod was and the kind of political climate he came into power as. It's really twisted. It's really weird. He's really corrupt. He's incredibly evil. That's kind of the general overview. So when they interact with him and interested in what they do about it, once the true nature of that power is revealed, their interaction with King Herod, to me, is really confusing. He means to kill Jesus, to slaughter him, and they meet with him and kind of give up his location kind of unknowingly. So as kings, if you will, they come and they start asking these questions, and the king hears about it, and so he wants a secret meeting with them. So they're kind of talking on the level, and I never thought of it that way before. They're just sort of, oh, yeah, well, where did you find the star? Oh, it's over here. Okay, great. So he's kind of already given it all up. So I think they're not even fully formed at this point about what the political climate they're getting into is. Their awareness of Herod's evil has yet to form. They hear it later in a dream, which to me is wild, too. I've never paid attention to my dreams. I've never acted like my dreams when I'm sleeping. I've never acted on them, so I think it's interesting to note that kind of activity is happening all over the place at this time in the story, that the people are just hearing dreams and just responding to them as if they were waking, So in a lot of ways, the Magi as people are forming. Their relationship with God is forming. Their journey is long and circuitous, but what struck me the most, what's the clearest about them out of this confusion, is their awareness of who Jesus is and their immediate joyful worshipfulness of him. So they're confusing characters in a chaotic story that for me leaves more questions than answers. So I focus on the clarity of their relationship with Jesus when they finally find him. So if you're feeling that your relationship with power structures in the world is confusing, like them, if your relationship with God is still forming, if you're part of an overall narrative that can be at times difficult to understand, like me, it's difficult to engage, take heart from the Magi. Focus on Jesus making a new home in us at Circle of Hope, because we're already doing it. When you find Jesus, joyously fall to your knees to worship him, recognize who he really is, and bring your gifts as an offering, whatever they are, whatever you've already been given. So part of my story is I had a long and tiring journey to get to Jesus myself. And along the way, and that's even being raised in the faith, it was still, it was a good journey, but kind of coming out of high school and particularly coming out of college, I was pretty exhausted. I was relationally exhausted and just was not finding what I was looking for. And what I was looking for was Jesus. And I couldn't really put a word to that. Along the way, I interacted with some really weird power structures and influences that begged my allegiance away from God. I could not say that then, definitely, but looking back, that's what was going on. But I was seeking Jesus in all of it and finally found Circle of Hope. And that's a funny and long story for another time, but when I did find us, I found Jesus and was overjoyed. I remember coming back from a PM one night. The first night I talked back at a PM, and I was telling Jenna all about this amazing place where they not only listen to what I say, but they take me seriously and it actually let me do stuff, as half-baked as I am. I mean, I've been talking all the time my entire life, and these people actually wanted to listen to me, and it made me really, finally found Jesus. I had been looking for years. And the funny thing is, you know, I'm a friendly enough guy. I had a lot of friends, but I was really isolated. I was really lonely with all the friends that I had. So here Jesus was as these people. That's what meant something to me, that it was really visceral that it was in these people who just, you know, would like listen and would want to dialogue with me as unprocessed as I was. They took me in, and I could never go back the way I came. So in the years that followed, through lots of dialogue and lots of cells and life experience, I came to realize, and I didn't think this before, but I came to realize that I had been given a lot by God, and that by following Jesus and sharing it all, my life could actually have some meaning. Prior to that, I was convinced that I only could like find meaning in what I did for a living. And you know what's funny though? I do that too. You know, because Jesus redeemed me, and he's showing me even how to redeem like the things, the irredeemable work that I do, making these weird buildings in the world that consume tons of resources. Like, he's even finding a way to redeem what I thought was unredeemable. So there's probably hope for you too. So the Magi were warned in a dream to resist Herod and return home by another path. The Magi resisted the will of evil. Worshiping Jesus was the one thing that gave their lives meaning. Ah, that might be a stretch. But they'd invested a lot into this. Hear me out. They'd invested a lot into this journey to help Jesus make a new home for us in the world. They may have been confused about the nature of King Herod at first, like when they interacted with him, but not about what to do once they found Jesus. So we all come into situations largely unaware of larger forces that want our allegiance, like the Herods out there, if you will. The more we become aware, the greater our responsibility to resist them and join in the collective effort to restore creation by helping Jesus make a new home. I think about how Circle of Hope taught me what forgiveness really is, and particularly what it's not. And it was a really difficult lesson that I should say I'm really still learning. I had a good lesson today about that. And how hard it is during the holiday season to not go back the old way, you know, like back to Herod, essentially, metaphorically, when I'm around my extended family, where there's daughters who won't speak to their father, you know, even when they just had a, you know, one of my cousins just had a baby, but she won't even let her dad see the kid. There's brothers that won't talk to each other after years. They're just like, no, we won't reconcile. And we're going to be declarative about that to the other family members. That's two small examples of some of the stuff that kind of comes up during the holiday season. And the worst thing is if true forgiveness ever does happen, we're kind of taught not to talk about the suffering and the pain and the unreconciliation, because you're supposed to focus on the good things that happened this last year. You're supposed to just kind of like, let's not dredge up the negative stuff. Don't dredge up the pain. Don't dredge up the suffering. It's really difficult. And for me, I just thought that was a good way growing up, because it was positive, right? And what I didn't realize is it was diminishing my pain. It was diminishing true reconciliation. And it's like it's an unfortunate environment where nothing can really grow in. I love my family, even. I still love my family, even with all that stuff. So being a part of Circle of Hope, finding a new road, finding a new home in Jesus, we get a lot of training around here, particularly the cell leaders. There's this sort of endless repository called the lore, and kind of like the Hobbit in a way too. But there's this wonderful bit about what forgiveness is and what forgiveness isn't. It's like a, you know, if you're running into a situation where there's irreconciliation, and if you're trying to do anything in the world that involves people, there's going to be unreconciliation. It's really difficult. So you have to relentlessly relate to people and just keep trying to work it out. And this was a good, I want to go over just a couple of quick things. This was a good list for me. This is 5 reasons to not forgive, by this guy David Augsburger, who wrote a great book, Caring Enough to Forgive and to Not Forgive, in the early 80s. He says, and if, you know, in the quotes, it's kind of like fake forgiveness, so I'm not going to air quote every time. That's tiring. So when forgiveness puts you one up as the generous one, the giver of freedom and dignity, you're kind of like, I of course I'll forgive you. You were wrong. No problem, you know. When forgiveness is one way, calling one person to accept the difference, absorb the pain, adjust to injustice. Forgiveness has to be a two-way street. When forgiveness distorts feelings by denying that there was hurt, pretending that all is forgotten, sort of like, whatever, it's all good. Let's just not talk about what was wrong with us. Just stop talking about it already. It's fine. You're forgiven. Like, that's not forgiveness. When forgiveness denies anger and acts as if it never happened. You know, anger sometimes can be a really good, it's not good to like live in anger, but having that sort of righteous indignation as a jump off point to some real reconciliation, probably shouldn't deny that stuff. And when forgiveness ends the openness of a relationship and leaves people cautious, safely concealed, afraid to risk free and open and spontaneous living. We're always talking about trying to create a safe place around here, and if you hear that for like 10 years or something, it's like, it's very repetitive. It's, you can't get away from this idea, but we're talking about, we want a place where people can live free, open, and spontaneous to like kneel and worship Jesus and kind of do that in PMs and cell meetings and mission teams and compassion, all these different ways we express ourselves as the church. We want to be free and open and spontaneous. Unreconciliation, gossip, things like that, just squelch that stuff. And expect it. We're all addicted to sin, but like working it out is the way to do it. It's the gift of community. So I learned that there's a better way. And oop, there we go. How to forgive. So instead of focusing on the like how not, like here's what you should not do. It's not a list to tell you how bad you're already doing it. It's just to recognize, oh, I wasn't forgiving and I wasn't being forgiven. That's a good moment to be like, man, I want the good stuff. This is it's a list. Like you kind of use it. It's not the real thing. You kind of have to act on it. But like one of the first things I think is good is just to realize wrongdoing. Recognize to what degree we have participated in the wrongdoing. That's real tough for me because I'm always right. You have to reaffirm love. I love this one because you have to see the wrongdoer. And that even means you, if you're looking in the mirror and you know you were wrong. You have to see yourself. You have to see the other person the way God sees them, which might be hard, but just even see them in their fullest self as you could imagine in the self. They aren't even yet, you know. That's how Jesus sees us. Release the past. You have to overcome resentment and suspicion, which can be hard. This is a good one. Renew by repenting. You have to recognize that a wrong has occurred and that both parties have acknowledged it and have dealt with it responsibly. And the tough thing about forgiveness is, and reconciliation is, realizing that no matter how much more wrong one person is than the other, these sort of like levels of wrongness or, you know, percentage, that just is like not, is never helpful. There's always someone who is more or less wrong or something, but realizing that both parties just have a role in the dance is a good starting point if you really want to reconcile. And usually the things that really tweak me the most, or I'm just like, you really hurt my feelings, if I really look at that, it's because I have such a deep capacity for the thing they did. It's like I'm looking in the mirror and I just don't like what I see. And it's real hard to forgive them because it's like, oh, I do that all the time. Oh my gosh. The last one is one of my favorites, rediscovering community. So community is just this thing that can be rediscovered all the time when you're in this relentless way of relating. It can feel tiresome at first, but it becomes an art form of relating where you get to, community is the crucible for people to keep being, a new home is made in them through Jesus. If you just gotta keep working this stuff out. And there's ways to do it, like, you know, you don't work out some of this stuff just in a public place like this. Oftentimes it's in, we have these things called containers where, think of it as like a very contained, safe place where reconciliation can actually happen. So if two people can't get along and they want to pull in some trusted people they know they can trust, we don't gossip about that. We kind of contain it so that actual healing can happen. It's a cocoon of healing. If you have like everyone surrounding this thing, just talking about it all the time, oh, did you hear they did this, they did that, I can't believe that. You can't, it's toxic. Nothing can grow out of that soil. And it's hard for me not to want to jump in to the mix because it's interesting, right? Hollywood gossip has taught me a lot. So I want to look real quick at this again. So all of this to say, this bit about forgiveness, about how not to forgive, about how to forgive, it's just one of the things I've learned being around Circle of Hope for a while, to know that I'm, forbidden's a strong word, but it's a good word. It's like I'm really forbidden to go, when I go home for the holidays, I need to not get drawn into all the drama. I need to be, like, if maybe I'm the healing presence in my family if I don't engage in the things that I'm getting drawn into. And to be honest, I don't really know how to do that because everyone else is not doing it. So I have to stick with the training and just sort of like, have those five R's just in my head. And so I walk in the door, I love my family, and I'm just not going to go there, and it feels okay. So that's, I don't want to go the old way home. Let's close this up. Let's try to be like the Magi. In a chaotic and confusing environment after a long journey, focus on finding and locating Jesus, as hard as that is. And as you do that, you're probably going to interact with some weird power structures and different relationships that, want you to rat Jesus out in a way. So maybe listen to your dreams too. I hadn't thought of that until now, but they probably have something to tell you. When you find him, joyously worship him and offer the gifts you've been given. Don't go back the way you came. Resist evil and risk your reputation and move towards your fullness to do God's work of homemaking in the world. Sharing of yourself shapes the talents you bring to be in the light, generating a multiplicative love that seeds more and more and more love. We can't go back the same way we came. Jesus is going to be known to anybody who wants to find him and recognize him for who he is, and we need to go forward together, developing a longing for home in Jesus. I was reading Psalm 137 this week, and I heard it in a new light, and I just thought I would just read it again. Maybe you can hear it. So a couple weeks ago, Isaiah was teaching us to long for home, and listen to this in that sense, as you're longing for a home that is now and is yet to be at the same time. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion, our homeland. There on the poplars, we hung our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. So long for home as Jesus comes to make a new home in us. So let's pray, and then there'll be some time to talk back if you want. God, thanks so much for making a new home in us as you come